From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. The phenomenon of organized pub trivia contests can be traced back to the late 1950s in the United Kingdom, and it made its way to the United States in the 1980s. And then by the early 2000s, there were pub quizzes in thousands of American bars. Also in the early 2000s, the TED Talk was taking off. That's the annual conference in Monterey, California, that was growing bigger and bigger each year. And videos were starting to go viral of speakers like Jeff Bezos talking about the future of the internet and Richard Dawkins talking about militant atheism. This is also when Nerd Night began. Chris Balakrishnan was a graduate student studying evolutionary biology at Boston University in 2003 when he and the owner of a local bar called the Midway Cafe hatched a plan to start hosting short lectures for bar patrons. And this thing, it sort of took off. By 2006, Nerd Night had spread to New York, and that's where Matt Wazowski started working to grow the event series across the rest of the United States and in venues across the globe. Today, Nerd Night Tokyo is held on the second Friday of each month at the World Peace Theater. Recent speakers there have discussed how to defeat cancer and the cultural and moral significance of ChatGPT. Nerd Night Sydney happens on the third Tuesday of the month at the Friend in Hand Pub. Its recent lectures have spoken about how music can be used to treat dementia and why social media is filled with antisocial behavior. But if there's not a Nerd Night like you, you're not out of luck. Chris and Matt still want to hook you up. And to that end, they've edited a new book. It's called How to Win Friends and Influence Fungi. It includes 70 of their fellow nerds writing about everything from artificial gravity and science fiction to the science of dating apps to the mathematics of gossip. And it's true, a book isn't the same as a bar, but there's really nothing stopping you from mixing yourself a drink before sitting down to read. Chris Balakrishnan is the founder of Nerd Night, and he's an ornithologist who specializes in the genetics, evolution, and speciation of birds, especially those that engage in what he very scientifically describes as wacky behaviors. Chris, welcome.
Thanks, Matthew. Good to be here. Thanks for having us.
And Matt Wazowski is the head of Nerd Night in all its various iterations. He's also a rabid sports fan who cheers for teams from Cleveland, which until fairly recently was widely regarded to be the most cursed sports city in the United States of America. Matt, welcome.
Thanks for having me here. Cleveland sports, not the best thing to root for. Doesn't mix with nerdery too well either.
Chris, let me start with you today. You started Nerd Night as a graduate student in Boston. Tell me about the first event at this little dive bar, the Midway Cafe, that you hosted.
Sure. So the first event, I don't know, it took me back to something like elementary school where you're maybe going to have a birthday party and you're not sure anyone's going to come. It was very much like that. And I was filled with trepidation. So I was hanging flyers and leaving little postcards in coffee shops. And that first event really occurred because the bartenders at the bar where we held it, they're actually curious about my research. So I spent a lot of time at this bar and I would disappear for months on end to go do research. And when I came back, well, they wanted to know what I had been up to. And at that point, you know, it kind of struck me that really none of my friends or my bartender slash friends knew what it was that I did when I was doing research. I thought that maybe doing presentations at a bar might be a good way to convey what it was that I was doing to friends, family, and more.
So were you like the first guy? Were you the first Nerd Night lecturer? Or did you have other people on hand on that first night as well?
Initially, when we had this idea of doing science at the bar, I wasn't sure how to do it. And I thought that just me being on stage wouldn't work. So I decided to try to drag in two other friends of mine, basically, to present along with me. We got three presenters, we took turns, and we tried to make the nerdy version of a rock concert.
You know, the danger if you are a musician playing in a bar is that people are going to just let you be background music while they carry on with their conversations. That's also the danger here, right? I mean, if you guys aren't doing something that is interesting and feels important to the people in that bar, they're going to turn their attention elsewhere and even talk over you. Did you have that experience, or were they pretty locked in?
This particular place, this was really luck and not strategy. It was small enough that it was very hard for that to happen. And again, because the bartenders, they were all paying attention. They were all engaging in lighthearted heckling, as we like to call it. The bar itself really set the tone for the events. It turns out as soon as you start talking about things like bird sex, the audience is engaged. It works almost every time.
And then this thing starts to grow, and there's this decision you have to make because you are a bird nerd and you have this whole other blossoming career as a bird scientist. And it was going to take a lot of energy to keep growing this event series. And that's where Matt comes into the picture.
That's right. And I think Matt and I will both tell you that we at no point in these early days did we expect it to still be going 21 years later. You know, we did it and continue to do it because it was fun and seemed like a fun thing to do. and the shows were fun to do. But the spread was maybe more luck than strategy, at least at the start.
Matt, what was your first Nerd Night event? How did you get conned into becoming involved in this thing?
Yeah, so conned is probably the accurate term for that. So since 1999, I had been running standard bar trivia nights across Brooklyn and Manhattan. And because, you know, my dear pal Chris was running this weird thing in Boston, I came up to most of the shows. I would drive up. So I probably saw the majority of the Nerd Nights in Boston the whole time this was going on. So this was from 2003 to 2006. You know, Chris was always like, hey, you should do Nerd Night in New York. It would be fun there. And I would always, you know, put up my cool New Yorker front and say, oh, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. New York is way too cool for this.
It's really hilarious that you thought you were too cool for Nerd Night when, might I remind you, you were hosting bar trivia.
There's nothing ironic about that whatsoever. and so I'm like, it'll never fly. And then after literally 2 years of sort of thinking about it and hemming and hawing and mostly thinking it was utterly preposterous, we decided to give it a try. And fortunately, I knew I had a friend of a friend who owned a similarly small dive bar in the East Village. And so we gave it a shot. Chris came down to give the first presentation in New York, being the Nerd Night celebrity that he was. I had a roommate at the time who was into food policy. So he talked about food insecurity, which is always a great way to get the people excited and entertained. And then the third presentation was African iconography in Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie videos. So what was interesting about it to me was that after the first three or four events that we did at the bar in New York, it was always sold out. It sold out ahead of time. And by the fourth or fifth one, literally there's a wall of glass windows and you would just look outside and people's faces were pressed up against the glass trying to look inside. And so I was like, well, you know, Chris, New York is the, you know, New York's the melting pot. Everyone has experts across all walks of life. And so if I bring Nerd Night to New York, I would like to do it across all subject matters and disciplines to represent that wonderful breadth of expertise that New Yorkers have. And so I wanted to kind of grow it a little bit beyond science.
Okay, so we've got ornithology, we've got food insecurity, we've got iconography of pop music in the 1980s. Why does this work? Because what you are describing right now, this is just college lectures, right? Like short college lectures. But I'm a college lecturer, and I've got to say, I've never had anybody pressing their face up against the window of my classroom. So is it just about the alcohol? What is it that makes this work so well for you guys?
I came to this from a non-academic standpoint. And so what was interesting was that, you know, at this time, there was nothing, there's sort of this adult edutainment thing, whatever the term is these days. It didn't exist beyond bar trivia. I had not heard of TED Talks when this started. I was apparently very naive. And so I think what was kind of fun about it was that, you know, the alcohol helped, but it was all really just the tone. And to what Chris alluded to earlier about the midway kind of, the midway sort of setting the stage, that's critical to what this is. Having positive heckling from the audience, having people literally encouraging people to drink and enjoy themselves while doing it, but then also making sure that the presenters always had a very specific balance of formality and informality where they can talk, they can swear, they can talk about sex, they can make elongated pop culture analogies to their subject matter, anything to sort of bring it down. The attitude was always, if you had to explain what your work or research is to your friends or family or cousins or someone who doesn't know and has no formal training in whatever it is you're an expert about, how would you talk to them like a normal human? And somehow just really kind of bring it down to an accessible level, I think really did wonders.
Tell me about the role of the hecklers in all of this, because I do feel like this has got to be part of the secret sauce and a reason the audience is so engaged and involved.
Definitely. And again, I would definitely say that it was the bartenders at the Midway that set this culture, which is basically they felt comfortable interrupting speakers at any time, either to crack a joke or to ask for additional information. But when I think about it, it's like when we're talking about science, we say so many weird things that as scientists, we don't even reflect on how weird it is that we're saying those words together in a row. And a general audience that's comfortable will just call you out on it. You said some obvious sexual innuendo without laughing or breaking a smile. Like, how do you even do that as a scientist? You know, and it could be in any context, but the bartenders could make it into a sex joke. And I don't know. That really encouraged everyone who was in the audience to participate.
So, like, for instance, you are an ornithologist. Your talk touches on bird sex. And when you say the words cloacal kiss, the bartenders are right on that, right?
That's exactly right. There was not a moment of silence between cloacal kiss and something from the bartenders.
Now, I feel like this is really what good bartenders do, right? They're like, you know, they're behind the bar, but they're sort of like coming into and out of the various conversations at any time, jumping in, adding something, introducing an idea, and then sort of drifting away. So these guys and gals, presumably, were really well positioned to sort of fill this role in the Nerd Night formula. And I imagine this is part of why Nerd Night has really remained this distinctively live event phenomenon. And I'm really curious about this because unlike TED and, you know, really more like pub trivia, you don't record your shows. Why is that?
It is mostly out of practicality, the practicality of laziness, against a lot of the ethos of the last 15 years of, you know, when you do something, it needs to, you need to go viral and you need to make a $1 billion business out of something. You know, true to the nature of this, that's something that we never, ever, ever wanted to do. I mean, now managing Nerd Night globally, I literally spend 30 to 50 hours a week doing this. And I mean, it's been like that for 16 or 17 years now. And I make ones of dollars a year doing this, and sometimes dozens on a good year. And the point is that we always just want this to be a fun thing. We all have day jobs. I've been a working adult for 27 years now, and that's how I pay my mortgage and my bills. And I want this to just be the fun, goofy thing that keeps life sort of interesting and enjoyable. So we've never wanted to do it where our livelihoods were dependent upon it, which then gets to the recording and pieces like that. So I've calculated that over the 21 years of Nerd Night, we've had somewhere between 18,000 and 22,000 presentations. I think we've got less than 50 videos on the YouTube channel. So yeah, I think having, 45 presentations out of 22,000 is probably a pretty low ratio, but I honestly don't really see that changing very much.
So I was going to add something, I guess, that maybe relates to your previous question about the secret sauce and the maybe the expansion here, because we haven't said anything about this yet. So in each different city, right, the events are organized by a local boss, right? And so we, Matt and Chris, have offloaded a lot of that work to these very passionate people who live all over the world. And they really do a lot of the heavy lifting, and they do it, out of their love for the game and for the events. And so in terms of Nerd Night events and their flavor, right, they actually vary also a lot from place to place. So because people are tailoring it to their interests and to their city. And so each one has its own like character, I think, that matches that of the city it's in. And so that also, I think, adds to the appeal. There are some things in common, like the things we've talked about, the lightheartedness in a general way and the topical coverage. But then there's also this independence of each of the events, and people get back from it what they put in. I think that helps.
You guys actually list these bosses at the back of the book, and there are hundreds of these people. So these are folks who have been taken by this, not so much because they're fans, but they want to be a part of it.
So in 2009, about 2.5 years after we started doing the events in New York, with a couple of people who were regulars there who just moved out of town and literally emailed me, and they're like, oh, I really miss going to Nerd Night. I've just moved to Toronto and Austin. Would it be cool if I started it there? And I was like, oh, yeah, that seems cool. And so, wrote some very basic guidelines. So basically, when you walk into Nerd Night Toronto or Nerd Night Austin or Nerd Night Melbourne or Nerd Night wherever, you want to sort of feel like Nerd Night, 80% of it's the same. But to Chris's point, that last 20%, 25% of the sort of local flavor is very important.
Okay, but you guys can't start this thing everywhere. You don't have enough people to start it everywhere, even with all of these volunteer bosses. So then you were like, well, maybe we should make all this cool stuff more accessible to people who can't come to our events. To do that, let's use this 600-year-old technology called the printing press. Chris, when did the idea of a book come about, and how did it come to fruition?
It's been a very short turnaround from the idea of maybe having a book to there being a book available in stores now. I think it's been something like a year and a half since this all started. And it started, oddly, when Matt moved from New York, which I gather is where a lot of book people live, to LA, where a lot of like movie people live. But somehow in moving to LA, Matt came in contact with a book agent, and that book agent had attended a Nerd Night and thought this should be a book, and then asked Matt and I to work on a pitch. And that pitch, shockingly to us, was basically immediately accepted. And then that we were off and running, and now there's a book. It's really wild and just as well planned as everything else we've done.
This is really the dirty little secret of books in America. Most of them were just some random idea that some book agent had, often, by the way, when they were drunk.
that seems to be the case here. And Matt, did I get most of that right?
So this book is it's a collection of 71 presentations from around the world, but they're all, as Matthew said in the beginning, they're all just these very short, digestible 3 to 4 page snippets. It was a tribute to the passion and enthusiasm of the presenters, of the Nerd Night bosses around the world. They're obviously the engines behind all of this, and the fact that they could showcase their work on dead trees to people around the world seemed like an appealing pitch.
You guys, when I wrote my first book, after it published, a lot of people came to me and they said, "Your book was so easy to put down." And I was like, oh, thanks. But what I've come to realize is that what they were saying they were appreciating was that they could pick it up. They could read a few pages. They could learn something interesting and amusing. And then they could pick it up again later. And that's the kind of book this is as well. But this is not the sort of thing that a lot of people would probably think about when they think about science writing. And this digestibility is part of the magic.
Again, at the end of the day, like, we just want this to be digestible, accessible, fun, silly. And I think it's easier to be digestible, accessible, fun, and silly in 5 to 8 minute increments than in, 5 to 8 hour increments. So I think the form and function, I think, are very closely tied to each other.
And that's really reflected in your chapter, Chris. This is basically like only 2 pages long, but you get a lot into those pages. In those 2 pages, I learned birds are indeed the descendants of dinosaurs. And so little dinosaurs like Compsognathus probably tasted like chicken. I also learned that most bird sex is really fast. But it turns out that duck sex is really terrifying. And I also learned that parasitic birds are all kinds of messed up. Chris, tell me about parasitic birds.
Parasitic birds were the subject of my first Nerd Night talk. And that's what I actually study. And what is a parasitic bird? Well, they're birds that, rather than building their own nests and raising their own young, they lay their eggs in the nests of other bird species. And then those other bird species raise their young. So they're very unbirdy in a lot of ways, right? When you think of birds, you usually think of nests, but these birds don't build nests at all. They just take their eggs, lay them in another nest, and then they're done with them. They don't provide parental care to them. It actually turns out they wind up laying way more eggs than birds that are not parasitic. So you can think about it as literally taking the cost of child rearing and spending it on laying hundreds of eggs instead of tens of eggs.
This is just such a clever evolutionary strategy, right? Like, you don't expend energy on building nests and rearing young. You do expend energy on having sex and laying eggs, and then you outsource the parenting. And if people enjoy hearing about these sorts of things, this is what this book is for, or this is what Nerd Night is like. If you're the kind of person who listens to the kind of show like this show, or just listen to you, Chris, talk about parasitic birds, and you were like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. I wish I could do that with a beer in my hand. That's your demographic, right?
That's right. So we've had different sort of taglines for Nerd Night over time, and that sprung up at different venues. But one of those bartenders from the Midway came up with one that was like, it's like the Discovery Channel, but with beer.
Matt, you've written before that everyone should feel welcome in the world of sports. And that does appear to be something that is starting to happen. The demographics for sports fans are shifting and widening. What is it going to take to make everyone feel welcome in the world of science, above and beyond the question of just the language that we use?
A lot of people just don't understand the sort of every day, every hour, every minute practicality of how science is affecting them. I'm like, I don't know, the fact that you are using a piece of technology in your hand that's more powerful than, you know, how we launched Apollo 18, and it's going from your brain through your fingers to a satellite 30 miles above the Earth and then back down in a fraction of a second, you know, that's science working for you. I think as you just sort of realize that everything around you to some extent is science and helping you live a better daily life, I think that just kind of appreciating the nuance and the, I guess, ubiquity of it. I think having that perspective can really help people grow and appreciate it.
That's Matt Wasowski. He is a co-founder and head of Nerd Night and the co-author of How to Win Friends and Influence Fungi. Matt Wasowski, thank you.
Thank you. This was incredibly terrific, and I hope we are influencing fungi and fun gals around the world.
And we were also joined today by Chris Balakrishnan, who is also a co-founder of Nerd Night and also a co-author of How to Win Friends and Influence Fungi, which is available at bookstores and online now. Chris, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us, Matthew.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.